After a two-year silence, the special counsel goes public and does not exonerate the president. Good Thursday morning. We're live from Studio 5, and this is First Coast Connect. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this hour, Robert Mueller speaks. Will it ultimately lead to impeachment for the president? You can join the conversation now with your thoughts. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, helping your ADHD-bound college student. Some advice from an expert. Plus, it's a dynamite new exhibit at the Mosh. We'll tell you about that. All of that and more just ahead this morning. But first this hour, special counsel Robert Mueller on Wednesday declined to clear President Trump of allegations of obstruction of justice. Mueller gave his first public remarks yesterday, explaining his two-year-long investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. Mueller also said that while Justice Department policy prohibits charging a sitting president with a crime, the Constitution provides for another process to formally accuse a sitting president of wrongdoing. It was a clear reference to the ability of Congress to begin impeachment proceedings. Now, Mueller's words have increased the drumbeat among Democrats in Congress calling for impeachment of the president. What would that process look like? We're beginning the hour with a look at the legal issues and the politics as we welcome Matt Corrigan. He's Dean of College of Arts and Sciences at Jacksonville University, new in the position after many years at UNF. Matt, good to see you.
Thanks, Melissa.
And local attorney Michael Stansky of Stansky Law here with us.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to have you, Michael. And here's our question to callers. What's your reaction to the special counsel's public statements yesterday? Give us a call at 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. And a minute ago, we didn't have a little bit of sound from Robert Mueller. We have it now.
If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. We did not, however, make a determination as to whether the president did commit a crime.
Okay, parsing the legalese in Robert Mueller's statement yesterday, Matt Corrigan, let's begin with you. Extraordinary to hear the special counsel say, if we had confidence the president of the United States did not commit a crime, we would have said so.
Yeah, you know, I think my jaw was on the floor really during that whole statement. It was an extraordinary statement, and it contradicted itself a little bit, because if the report should speak for itself, then why did he come out and make a statement? Because he wanted to emphasize some points. And clearly, he wanted to emphasize that they had not exonerated the president. He wanted to really talk about the idea that, in his interpretation of DOJ policy, you cannot indict a sitting president, and you cannot even get near that standard because it's not fair, because the president can then not respond to it in a court of law. To me, that's a bit bizarre. And I do think that really stretches what the founders were looking at.
In terms of the separation of powers,
you know, you had the Virginia plan, the New Jersey plan, all sorts of plans at the founding of our country, trying to figure out a way to have a strong executive, but an accountable executive. And this interpretation of DOJ policy to say that basically a president can do anything they want in office unless they get impeached, I think really stretches it.
It's 549-2937 to join us. Do you agree with the Democrats in Congress that impeachment proceedings should begin against President Donald Trump, or disagree with that notion? We'll go to your calls in a moment. Michael Stansky of Stansky Law. You know, the other thing about Mueller's comments yesterday that struck a lot of people was how sharply he departed from the earlier comments of Attorney General William Barr, who had the first public remarks about the special counsel's report, saying that there was really nothing to see here, in effect, were the AG's remarks. Mueller had a very different tone yesterday and basically refuted the comments of his former boss, because it is now his former boss. He has now left the Justice Department after completing this investigation.
No, absolutely. And I think that this goes to the heart of where we are as far as interpreting these policies, interpreting these statutes, looking at the Constitution. You have a divergent point of view. And right now, everybody is focused on what's the AG and what Robert Mueller, but I'm sure there's going to be plenty of voices starting to speak up with their own interpretations.
And let's talk about, first of all, how difficult it might be for the average person to interpret the comments of Special Counsel Mueller, Matt. Certainly, Democrats in Congress will call upon him to testify publicly before Congress. He indicated yesterday he does not want to do that. He could be subpoenaed to testify. Unlike a lot of other people who've been called to and been subpoenaed by the Democrats, he's not likely to blow off, ignore a congressional subpoena. We could be hearing more from him soon. At the same time, the politics of this are what I wanted to ask you about. Impeachment is a political process, and there isn't currently majority support among the American public to impeach this president. That could change depending on what else is revealed. That certainly happened during the Watergate impeachment era. But right. It's a political process, and certainly the Democratic leadership, Speaker Pelosi and others, they are not, it doesn't seem to be, they don't seem to be inclined at this time to move forward with such a serious process.
Yeah, I think Speaker Pelosi has placed a very high bar for beginning impeachment inquiry, because she's basically saying that if it's not going to go anywhere in the Senate, why do it? Well, I can save you the trouble. This Senate's not going to impeach or not going to confirm an impeachment removal from office, President Trump. But that doesn't mean that the House doesn't have a responsibility to deal with some of these issues. And that's why I think Mueller's press conference is so frustrating, because he basically just handed off this stink bomb and said, you all figure it out. And, you know, the House of Representatives can have a responsibility to investigate some of this. And even if it doesn't mean, you know, in the Senate, he will be found guilty, that doesn't mean the House is off of its responsibility.
At the same time, too, Michael Stansky, Mueller went out of his way several times to talk about the systematic efforts by the Russians to interfere in the 2016 election, a matter he said ought to concern every American. And there is every indication that we will see this again in 2020. We aren't sufficiently protected from these kinds of cyber attacks.
No, absolutely. And we saw that with the revelations last week, that two Florida counties had been hacked. So this is an important issue. And I think that if you watched the press conference yesterday, you saw Robert Mueller's frustration, the fact that there has been either no response or very timid response to the fact that a foreign government in fact cyber attacked the United States.
Honestly, that's I realize we're in an incredibly partisan, polarized era, Matt, but wherever you stand politically, that should concern you, because if the Russians can set about making conditions better for a Republican candidate now, they can certainly do the same down the road for the other party.
Yeah, and this is an example where lots of different areas crisscross. And you know, one of the things that we try to do at the JU is have lots of different disciplines interact. And here you have a computer issue of trying to figure out hacking, and then trying to figure out the ethics of that and trying to figure out how you're going to control that. I don't know if you're going to be able to control something like that. And if you're not going to be able to control something like that, then the consumers of that information, you and I and the public, are going to have to get more sophisticated, that anytime anything pops up in our social media, that we don't react and we don't, you know, forward it if it's not correct. That's a tall bar. And also I'd add, Melissa, with this influence from foreign nations, especially Russia, with all of the online fundraising that these candidates do, are you telling me all these campaigns really follow up to see if the person who says they are contributing are really that person? What we need to look at, and you've seen it in Europe and you've seen it in other places, are the extremes. And when you see social media promoting these extremes on the left and the right, your antenna needs to go up, because that could be a foreign nation.
Both Facebook and Twitter have refused to take down a doctored and fake video of House Speaker Pelosi appearing to be drunk or impaired, saying that it's free speech. Michael, you know, in 2020, voters should be prepared, I think, for an absolute ocean of disinformation and misleading or false videos and articles that look like news articles but are actually fake. They're propaganda. They're not from reputable sources. Because the social media giants have made it clear that they are not going to be responsible actors. Because they have become news platforms, but they refuse to adhere to the norms of journalism and strike out content that is false and that is intended to weaponize propaganda and literally mislead voters into believing things that are absolutely false.
Absolutely. But we're entering into this great gray zone that we're in right now. Absolutely, the video is free speech. However, Facebook is a private entity. They are not bound by any type of those regulations. So could they take it down? They certainly could. But, I mean, this is the gray zone that we're at.
They're not currently bound by these type of regulations. What do both of you think about the increasing calls to regulate these massively influential social media platforms? They have become purveyors of news and information.
Yeah, again, and you know, I mean, Michael can give the constitutional take on this, but you know, the freedom of speech is paramount in our Constitution. The judiciary generally has taken a very broad view of that. So I think it's going to be difficult because let's say that you come up with some regulations for Facebook and Twitter, someone can create another social platform, and I do think there needs to be some regulation. Legally, I'm not sure how you get there, but I think really where the answer's got to lie, Melissa, is the consumers of the information. That, you know, we've all learned if we get an email from a prince in Nigeria.
Don't open it.
So we're going to have to get to that level with social media.
What are you talking about? I opened one just last week. So I shouldn't have done that?
We're going to have to get to that level. And just because you see something in your feed that says, you know, that Joe Biden is the worst person in the world and wants to do all sorts of things, doesn't mean you have to retweet it. And that's a tall order for a lot of people.
All right, let's go to your calls now. What are your reactions to Robert Mueller's remarks yesterday as calls on the Democratic side grow for impeachment? What's your reaction to that? It's 549-2937. Bill is in Ortega. Hi, Bill. Good morning. Bill, you're on the air. Okay, Bill, give us a call back. Edwin is down in Bartram. Hi, Edwin. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me on.
Sure. Go ahead.
Well, just real quick, I believe that all of this is going to come down to us voting as much as possible, as many of us as possible, to vote some of these people out. What happened yesterday, I think it was pretty sad. Nothing concrete was mentioned. It was left up to Congress. And as you mentioned it before, if impeachment is a process and it's a political process, very few are going to have any faith in that. So I think it all comes down to us, the public, to vote for the best people possible, regardless of party, but hopefully not those who are supporting what's happening in the White House, Washington. This is really bad. I think it is really bad. I can't believe I'm saying this sort of thing in this time in our history, but that's it.
Okay, Edwin, thanks. And, you know, Michael, he's right in that. About half the country would regard impeachment as a partisan witch hunt, or however you want to characterize it. The other half would see it as a necessary and just check on executive overreach and allegations of corruption. And so, and as Matt pointed out, the Senate, certainly this current Senate, would not convict and remove President Trump. And so, you know, when we look at the impeachment of Bill Clinton in the 90s over the Monica Lewinsky affair, that was how that process was interpreted. And it seems as though the Democrats are reluctant to begin impeachment proceedings because they are concerned about the type of backlash the Republicans experienced in the 90s when they impeached Bill Clinton. Is that a fair concern some 20 plus years later.
I'm glad that you brought up the Clinton impeachment, because I think that if your listeners want to be informed on the process, they should certainly go onto YouTube. C-SPAN has the whole thing up there. And it would be very informative for your listeners to understand about the process. And the Senate politically there is some problems with getting this through, but as Matt pointed out, the House has the responsibility to investigate and to move forward if that is what they want to do.
We have an email from Stephanie in Avondale. She says, at what point is the Congress required by their job description to impeach a sitting president to fulfill their oath to the American people? The talk revolves around the political implications of impeachment, but where is the moral obligation to set a precedent to protect the office of the presidency and the rule of law? Matt.
Yeah, they're not required. It's a political decision, and so there's no requirement. They've got to make that decision. I agree with the tone of the letter that if the House Democrats feel that the president has committed crimes, that they're really obligated to do something, even trying to judge the political impact. Remember where we were this time in the last election cycle, Melissa. No one thought Donald Trump would be president of the United States. And so the idea that you're going to be able to predict the political implications 18 months out, I think, is a little, optimistic. And more importantly, again, what Robert Mueller said yesterday with DOJ policy was to basically give the president a blank check while in office. I think that's dangerous. And I think the House has to do something, doesn't necessarily have to be impeachment, but at least get Mueller before them and get a clear idea of what he's talking about. I don't think the report solely speaks for itself. Like there could be this question. Did the potential obstruction impede the investigation of the first part of the report? We don't know the answer to that. There's at least five questions that could be asked of Robert Mueller, and I think he needs to be brought before Congress. That we paid a lot of money as taxpayers for this investigation, for a 10-minute non-interview. It was just a statement. I mean, I think we can do better than that.
Ricardo, lots of emails and tweets. Here are just a few. Ricardo emails the show. Not to take from your audience, but everyone should listen to the entire report. It's available on podcast. If you listen, you know the president obstructed and anyone else would have been indicted. Andy emails the show. Previously, I was hesitant about impeachment. However, I am more in favor now. It seems the rule of law is threatened by inaction in the face of such corruption and lawlessness. Here's an email from Ronald. Congressman Rutherford sent out a weekly newsletter saying Mueller report exonerated Trump and we need to move on. I doubt he's read the report. He speaks the party line rather than distinguish himself as a thinker, leader, and patriot. It is accurate to say that the report did not exonerate the president. On Facebook, Emily writes, I was not for impeachment until I heard his statement yesterday. I think it's clear we need to start an inquiry. They have started impeachment proceedings for way less on previous presidents. And it's clear the only reason they haven't started now is they are afraid they will lose votes. Even a Republican congressman has called for it. It's the only tool right now to move forward. She's referring to Michigan Congressman Justin Amash, Michael, the lone Republican in Congress, a libertarian leading Republican, who has been quite vocal in saying that the president he sees this as a lawless administration and feels impeachment is necessary.
Yeah, but I mean, they don't need his vote. The Democrats don't. I know this is kind of going to Matt's lane. I mean, it's a simple majority to get impeachment through. So they have the votes if they wanted to do this.
What about the fact that Amash held a town hall in his district the other night, a heavily Republican district, and received, for the most part, applause and cheers from his constituents, saying that they supported him in his lonely stance on the right side of the aisle to move forward with an impeachment inquiry.
I mean, that speaks to his. I don't know anything about his district, and I obviously wasn't there. But I think that speaks to a lot of concerns that Americans have on both sides of the aisle.
And what's important, Melissa, and Michael may know the number, but I think over 600 former former federal prosecutors wrote a letter saying that if anyone else had done what the president had done, there would have been an obstruction of justice charge put forth.
Here's an email from or a tweet from Jason. If Congress cannot enforce subpoenas, is there any other avenue than to begin impeachment? It's certainly been unprecedented to see officials connected with the administration, including cabinet members, openly defying congressional subpoenas.
Yeah, and I'll let Michael weigh in because that's more in his area. But it is an amazing circumstance that we've had all these refusals to come before Congress, where traditionally the executive branch has almost always gone before Congress.
But if we look into the last administration, the Attorney General Holder was held in contempt for refusing to.
He refused to testify as well,
and that was over the Fast and Furious matter, which was an ATF operation, and the courts ultimately ordered the Obama administration to turn over the paperwork that the Attorney General refused to. So, I think that shows that it does happen on both sides, but it speaks to the fact that the courts want transparency. And
how do you
order.
See the role of the courts adjudicating these matters now? Because there are so many fronts. there are lots of different court cases related to these matters moving ahead as we speak.
When it comes to impeachments, the courts are going to stay out of it as
right,
much as possible.
Right, but what about the investigations into the president's finances? The investigations into the inauguration, the investigations into the Trump Foundation, the investigations still that Mueller farmed out into the campaign itself. We're talking about five or six different active investigations, cases farmed out to the New York Attorney General's office, the Southern District of New York, the Northern District of Virginia. Those haven't gotten as much attention, but Mueller spun off a lot of investigatory prongs of this wheel to other jurisdictions, and they're still ongoing.
And I think that speaks to the strength of how the Department of Justice is set up with its independent U.S. attorneys. The fact that those investigations continue into their respective districts speak to the strength of that organization.
Let's go to Amore on the South Side. Amore, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
All right, so first and foremost, I feel that Barr had a responsibility. He had a responsibility to be honest and forthcoming about the true findings of the report. Because when you think about it, none of us have seen the unredacted version. Barr was one of the few, you know, he and his team were one of the few who actually saw the unredacted report. And the fact that they weren't honest about the findings, to me, speaks on what is still left unknown, right? So I think by opening up a inquiry of impeachment, if at minimum, it will allow the American people to get all of the facts. Because right now we're moving forward and we're operating in a muddy like atmosphere because we don't have all of the facts. We haven't even seen the full unredacted report. So I think opening up an inquiry to impeachment will at minimum give us a space to really find out what all really transpired.
Thanks for that. Matt Corrigan.
Yeah, I think this goes back, and Barr's role goes back to the basic idea of what are we trying to do here with a special counsel law. There used to be an independent counsel law, which had broader authority. The special counsel law was put in place to report to the attorney general. So is the special counsel process really a criminal kind of fact-finding process? If that's what's there for, then, you know, you're trying to protect the individual. You know, you get your rights as an individual and you know, we want to protect the innocent as much as possible. You got to prove guilt. So that's one process. And that's where I think the president has relied upon and his defenders have relied upon and said, hey, this is a criminal process. They didn't find anything. We're done. Or is it supposed to be a bigger playing field in terms of informing the Congress, informing the country of potential wrongdoing for the administration, and then handing that over to Congress. It's not clearly stated in the special counsel that that's what it's supposed to do. And so I think the special counsel, people are expecting two separate things. And it turns out we didn't do either one particularly well.
clear as mud, in other words. Lots of calls on this. Cindy is in Springfield. Hi, Cindy. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I wanted to comment that I felt like Mueller spoke yesterday because he was rebuking Barr, and he wanted to redirect Americans to the report, which is very clear and spells out the crimes and misdemeanors, if so to speak, of Trump and the campaign of Trump. He did not exonerate Trump, and in fact, he made it clear that there was evidence of collusion and corruption in the campaign and continuing in the Trump presidency. I think that we should all be very concerned about our democracy right now. There is a cover-up, and I feel like Barr has participated in that cover-up. Trump is a master of controlling the narrative, and he has shown that he has and bragged about not paying taxes, assaulting women, escaping debt, and working the system to his advantage. And now that's what he's doing with the presidency. So I think it's alarming what's going on, and I do hope that people, the Congress and the Americans, take seriously what's happening right now. Whether or not there should be an impeachment is another question, but certainly the investigation should continue. And the campaign and the administration and the people who were involved should not be able to escape the subpoenas, and we should get to the bottom of what's going on.
Thanks for that, Cindy. You know, Michael, Attorney General Barr was chosen by this president to replace first Jeff Sessions, then another guy named Whitaker, who was in the job very briefly, because Barr has an extraordinarily expansive view of executive power. And he wrote a letter to the president outlining his views. So what about the role of Attorney General Barr in all this?
Don't forget, he was also very well qualified for that job. He'd held a job prior. He's had a lot of experiences as an attorney at the top level. I think that whoever was going to have that job was going to have the same viewpoints, though. I mean, it's the same viewpoints of a strong executive branch that are being pushed forward as the judicial nominees from this administration. So that is a position that this president has taken, and he's going to move forward with those.
What do you think of the criticism of Barr, given that his role is not to serve as the president's personal attorney? His role is to serve as the top attorney for the United States of America.
And that's a true statement. But don't forget that he still is a part of the executive branch, and the responsibility for oversight comes from the other branch. So, I mean, I think that there are some criticisms, but there's also some criticisms to go all the way around on this issue. So I think that the Congress probably needs to step up more to address the concerns that those people have.
Matt Corrigan.
Yeah, I think Barr's role, and I agree with the caller that it was a brilliant pick by Trump. I think Barr's done exactly what President Trump wanted him to do, and done it, I think, with a kind of a veil of you know, legality and history. And so, especially that first press conference where basically he said, you know, the president didn't do anything wrong and he was frustrated. And he was frustrated, so he, you know, may have done some things he shouldn't have done. Well, I think we all get frustrated and we don't go off and do other things. And so, I think Barr is not going to show up particularly well in history, because he simply could have said, here's what Robert Mueller found. I'm gonna publicize it, and then I'm gonna move on. He tried to shape the narrative, and the narrative is not held up well.
The president has been tweeting about this just this morning, tweeting Russia, Russia, Russia. That's all you heard at the beginning of this witch hunt hoax, and now Russia has disappeared because I had nothing to do with Russia helping me to get elected.
Yeah. I think he's removed that tweet, but if you read that last line, helping me to get elected, I don't think that's what he meant to say. But again, that is a powerful statement that, you know, Russia was involved in the election. And again, I'm not sure why he tweeted that, but anyway.
All right. Well, let's take one more call. It's Rodney on the South Side. Go ahead, Rodney.
Hey, good morning. Unfortunately, we're on the verge of losing democracy as we've known it in the past. Democracy is a messy process, And I think this president doesn't like this messy process. As you can see that he supports the strong men and the dictators around the world, because that's what he wants to be. And our process of government gets in the way of that. And I feel like if we don't do something now to implement our checks and balances that are in place and curb those going forward in future administrations, we're on the verge of losing it. Thank you.
Thanks for that, Rodney. Certainly, Democrats are afraid of that, Michael. They are concerned about our democracy, the rule of law under this administration. And I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
I think that across the country, the rule of law is still strong. We don't have people, you know, absolutely defying what law enforcement and the government is trying to do. And I think that if we look at this from a historical point of view, there have been other crises or near crises in the Constitution. So I don't think we're there yet. I certainly think that that might be the filtered view of a lot of people. But I would encourage everybody to read the report, especially the fact findings of this Mueller report, because they are excellent. Their team went through a lot of work to get to where they are. I'm not talking about the conclusions. I'm not talking about the analysis. I'm talking about the facts. So if you look at the facts, I think that they certainly will lead people to a more informed decision or a more informed opinion.
Michael Stansky of Stansky Law and Matt Corrigan of JU. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
And much more still ahead. Later in the hour, a live performance by singer-songwriter Jessica Pounds. But up next, summer help for your student with ADHD. This is First Coast Connect, and we'll be right back.
I'm David McGowan, President and CEO of WJCT. Join me on June 18th for an evening with Frontline's Michael Kirk. We'll discuss his recent documentary on the Supreme Court and his distinguished career as one of this country's leading documentary filmmakers. That's Tuesday evening, June 18th. Visit wjct.org/events for tickets and more information.
WJCT's new podcast tells the stories of local people.
You have one of your soldiers laying there, and you have the person that is trying to kill your soldiers on the opposite side.
It wasn't so much that I felt guilty. I felt like it was impossible for him to love me.
I wasn't born with a crack pipe in my mouth. Thank you, Jesus. I'm not going to die with one.
What It's Like is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
From the roots of jazz with Louis Armstrong and Miles Davis to contemporary artists like Melody Gardot and Eric Toufas, 89.9 HD4 plays nonstop jazz 24/7 for the month of May.
Welcome back. Well, the transition from high school to college is tough for most students, but for those with ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, university life poses a host of academic and personal challenges. It can be tough. They are dealing with staying focused on their studies, meeting increased organizational demands. Now, school's just about out for the summer, but if you've got a student preparing to go off to college in the fall, or even a younger student, we've got some advice for you. Shauna Pearson is founder and president of Expert ADHD Coaching, and she's on the line now. Hey, Shauna, good morning.
Hi, Melissa. Good morning.
Thanks so much for being with us. First, let's begin by defining what ADHD is.
Well, you said it just earlier. ADHD is attention deficit hyperactivity, quote unquote, disorder. But that doesn't really explain it. So I just think of it as a person who has ADHD has a brain that has a very hard time compartmentalizing. Okay, so it's sort of like you're living inside of everything all at once right now. And it's just a very, you know, constant overflowing mix of information, which tends to lead to a huge amount of overwhelm on a minute-by-minute basis. So that's why a lot of the symptoms of ADHD are often a reaction to the overwhelm of information. And it's, you know, procrastination and inattention, disorganization, impulsivity. All of those standard symptoms are because it's just like there's all of this information in your brain all at once, and there's nowhere to put anything.
Right. And, you know, I have a child with ADHD, so we struggle with this at mm-hmm. home. And I think parents of kids with ADHD are really looking forward to the summer because they get a little bit of a break from trying to help their kids manage schoolwork, get assignments in on time. But before we know it, school will be upon us again. And in particular, let's talk about kids that have had the support of their parents all the way through school, but now they're off to college.
Mm-hmm.
Kids, college students with ADHD are 5 times more likely to drop out than those that don't have ADHD. So how can parents plan and support things for their child who's preparing for a college experience?
Well, there's a lot to do in the physical realm, right? Like how to get your child prepared in terms of what they should do for organization, and you know, making sure that they know how to schedule themselves, and even making sure that they know how to do basic things like laundry or cooking something healthy for themselves. Because you know, we have hundreds of clients who are college students who literally are living inside of mountains of laundry in their dorm rooms. Or their residence, and they're not eating well, and they feel awful physically, so which obviously doesn't help them with their studies. So there's that department, right? Is the physical department. And then I think equally as important is the mental and emotional department. So if you have a child who you've been supporting until the age of, you know, 17 or 18, and now they're going off on their own to hopefully graduate with something, they need to know what they want out of the experience. Because, you know, I speak to people all the time who don't have a clue, and they're completely aimless. And what happens for a person who has ADHD and they don't have any kind of intention or goal is they will be in reaction mode the entire time. And whatever happens to them, they will fall into that. So if there's a challenge or an obstacle or a major distraction, they will get completely off course because it doesn't, you know, there's no reason for them to stay on course because they don't have a huge goal or an intention that they want to get out of it. Now, the way I describe it for a lot. Yeah, go for it.
Another point you make is that pills mm-hmm. don't teach skills. Many of us with kids, a lot of kids with ADHD take medication, but you're saying pills mm-hmm. are not enough. Pills don't teach skills. How do we teach ADHD students the skills that they need to be successful, given the challenges that they face?
So that's a great question. There are so many tools and skills that people with ADHD can utilize that will make sure that will make them successful. The reason I always say pills don't teach the skills is because usually a person will go and they'll get a diagnosis from their doctor, and the only thing that they're given is a prescription. And most of the time, the prescription, I don't know if you know this because you mentioned that you have a family member who has ADHD, but the ADHD medication is a stimulant. It's like what we used to call back in the 80s speed, right?
Right.
It's really great at helping you focus, but it does not help you focus on the right things. So you know, adults who have ADHD can be on ADHD medication and easily be able to focus on their Twitter feed for 5 hours straight and not get anything done that day. So it kind of puts you into that hyper-focus mode. So you have to know what to do, and you have to have skills to get out of that and to get onto whatever you need to get done. So, you know, that would be, there's, you know, the skills along time management or how to study. Let's focus on how to study for college students. Often, you just have to think about waking up your brain. So what type of thing am I going to do to wake up my brain while I'm studying? Is it going to be reading this huge textbook and highlighting? Likely not, because that's going to put your brain to sleep unless you're really interested in the subject. So what you might want to do, and I'll just give you a very quick example, is using more of your senses. So not just reading. One thing that we love doing with our students is combining audio and visual together. So we have them study out loud, and then they're listening while they're studying. They're listening to what they're saying, but then they're also recording themselves. So they're studying out loud, they're reading it, they're speaking it, and then they have to play back the recording of what they've just said. So there's like three different modes of how they're learning the information, and that really improves their retention level of the information. So just using more of your senses, anything that can wake up your brain, because that's what people with ADHD need. They need to engage their brain. One thing that's really another skill that people with ADHD ought to use while they're in college is to be in some kind of motion while you're studying. You don't have to do this all the time. Obviously, that would be exhausting. But motion is like, it's like a natural stimulant for your brain, right? Think of it as like the natural medication. So you've got whatever you need to be learning. And, you know, I always recommend, like, take it to, you know, go on an exercise bike, go on an elliptical, walk around your dorm room. But if they're standing and reading the information, they will remember it so much better. And that really and helps a
lot. I think my seventh mm-hmm. grader instinctively gets that, because she, mm-hmm. she That's when awesome. She's trying to do homework, she can't sit still. Every so often she has to get up and run around. So
yeah, that's awesome. That's amazing. So the fact that you are great with that, and you're like, why are you running around? Because a lot of parents do that and they don't understand.
But right. So much of this is the parents trying, myself and so many others, trying to understand what will reach these kids, what will be the most effective.
Yeah.
Lots more information on mm-hmm. your website about how you can help children and young adults with ADHD. It's at Expert ADHD yes. Coaching. So check yep. that
or just,
out.
Just ADHD coaching is fine too. You'll get right to our website.
Excellent.
It's all about action.
All about action. And Shauna Pearson, yep. founder and president of Expert ADHD Coaching. So many parents and students out there need that help. So thank you as Great. We begin the summer break, but already thinking ahead to the fall. Thank you so much for sharing this with us.
You're welcome. Thanks, Melissa.
And up next, a live performance from singer Jessica Pounds, plus a dynamite new exhibit at the Mosh. We'll be right back.
Abel Bain Law, with over 100 combined years of experience in solving problems with practical legal strategies, Abel Bain Law is committed to your success by providing intelligent, efficient advocacy and legal counsel. Learn more at abelbeanlaw.com. The First Coast Free Thought Society book group will discuss Going Ape by Brandon Haught, which chronicles Florida's battles over evolution, beginning at 11:30 Sunday, June 2nd at a diner on Phillips Highway. Details at firstcoastfreethoughtsociety.org.
Wind farms, out on the water and electricity, sure, but it's going to be destructive to the bottom where we fish, and it's going to definitely hinder our abilities to make a living.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, and ill wind this way blows. That's next time on Marketplace.
Today at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, New York Times Supreme Court correspondent Adam Liptak talks about the court's direction on abortion, the role the court might play in challenges to President Trump, and how the court is changing with Trump's two appointees, Justices Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Tim Ryan was just 29 years old when he won his first term in Congress back in 2002. Today, he is one of more than 20 Democrats running for the White House, casting a vision for America's uncertain future.
We could either be afraid of these technologies or we can dominate them.
Your questions for Ohio Congressman and potential presidential nominee Tim Ryan, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. MOSH, the Museum of Science and History, has a brand new exhibit, and it's dynamite. That song was just for you.
Thanks,
MOSH curator Paul Bercier. He's here now to tell us all about it. Fred Flintstone would be proud. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so this new exhibit is called Expedition Dinosaur, and it's open now at the MOSH. You can't go wrong. People love dinosaurs. What will we see here?
So this is the first time in 4 years that MOSH has hosted an exhibition of animatronic dinosaurs. So we have a total of 10 that are animatronic. You can activate them yourself to different body parts. You can move the head, the neck, the tail, whatever you like. Some of them are motion activated as well, so it's really exciting.
So this is an amazing opportunity to learn about these creatures when they roam the earth. It's hands-on. For kids in particular, this is absolutely irresistible.
Oh, yeah. I think for kids and for adults as well. For the kids, we have lots of hands-on activities. So it's not just the animatronic dinosaurs, but we have a lot of hands-on interactive activities that kids can do, anything from a coloring table to a Pangea puzzle we actually have 2 dig pits. So you can pretend that you're a paleontologist with a brush and you're brushing away the dirt to expose some dinosaur skeletons. So it's really cool.
This is 3 different floors of the museum.
Yeah.
So it's basically they've taken over the museum at this point.
The dinosaurs have taken over we can't be more excited about that fact. So,
and you will all get out alive. It's not Jurassic Park. Now there's an event tonight at the MOSH in conjunction with Expedition Dinosaur.
Yes,
what's happening?
It's a MOSH After Dark event, and the information can be found on our website, themosh.org. You have to sign up for it. It is called Dinosaurs by Design. And so we are going to have someone from Indigo Arts Therapy, where people can actually make some art inspired by the things that we know about dinosaurs. I will be giving a short lecture about our very own dinosaur, an Allosaurus, some of the things we know about it, some of the things we don't know about it, and some of the fiction involved with dinosaurs, too.
So. Pretty exciting. So this exhibit is up now, runs through most of the summer. Go see it. It's Expedition Dinosaur at the Museum of Science and History on the South Bank. TheMosh.org is the website, TheMosh.org. Check it out. Curator Paul Bercier, kudos to you, and have fun with it.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. And finally, this hour, local singer-songwriter Jessica Pounds is working on a new solo album right now. We've got a special treat. It's a preview of her performance tonight at the Mudville Music Room as she prepares to sing live in studio for us. Hey, Jessica, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Melissa.
Good to have you on the show. So you've got some new music you've been working on up in Nashville. Tell us a little bit about the new album.
I do. Well, I was in a band, Canary in the Coal Mine, for about 6 years that played all around Jacksonville. When that band ended, I spent the next, several months kind of working on new material, revisiting songwriting. And I am ready to put that music out there. And so I'm working with a label, Dog Song Records, that's out of Jacksonville, Florida, between Jacksonville and Nashville, and like really putting out some great local
some great new music. Now, yeah. You'll be performing live tonight at Mudville Grill. That's where Beach and Atlantic Boulevards come together. We've got a preview right now. What are you going to sing for us?
This song is called Howl at the Moon.
Here she is, Jessica Pounds.
Please don't think you've pinned down my whole identity, because the magic lives right beside the volatility. I do my best to control the shadow side. Sometimes I feel it rising up inside, and I hail at the moon, and I hail at the moon, and I hail at the moon, and I
Jessica Pounds, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Jessica appears tonight at the Mudville Music Room in St. Nicholas. Go see her show. Meanwhile, that's our show. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. And we always want your feedback. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and join us tomorrow, where we'll take a look at all of the week's top stories with our Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.